From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And good morning from Arizona. It is Friday, June 15th, 2012, and we are broadcasting from our studios in the Feeding Arizona complex in Youngtown, Arizona, also home of the Valley View Community Food Bank. The Valley View Community Food Bank home for the next couple of weeks. They're going to be moving to their new location in Sun City proper, a big 36,000-square-foot complex where they'll be continuing to feed all of the people that are in need of due to the food shortages and the food insufficiency that we find ourselves in this country and in Arizona as well. I'm Pete Peters, and Deborah Brown is at home in the office at the house working on some big new changes coming to the Boomer and the Babe and some events and things that we're going to be involved in. So stay tuned for that information. But in the meantime, I want to get right into our program today. We have a very interesting guest and a very interesting conversation to have with him. My guest today is Dr. Ira Byock, MD, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and professor at Dartmouth Medical School, nationally and internationally recognized as a palliative care expert. Dr. Byock speaks to tens of thousands of medical professionals, patients, and family members every year. Doctor, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Pete, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, did I pronounce your name correctly? Is that
exactly
Byock?
Right. Yep.
Oh,
Byock.
Good. Well, very good. Well, this is a topic that we're going to have today based on your book, which is, of course, The Best Care Possible. I think it's an excellent title because anybody that has a relative or a loved one that's in under care for whatever the ailment or malady, you're always hoping to have the best care possible. But that best care possible might well take on different types, have different faces and different looks depending on what the illness is, the status of the patient, and so on and so forth. Is that a fair assessment?
You got it exactly right, Pete. I titled this book The Best Care Possible because, for one thing, that's what we all want. We may have different backgrounds. We may come from different religious backgrounds or ethnicities and traditions. We all have our individual preferences, but we all want the best care possible for ourselves and those we love. And so that's where I always start my conversations and relationships with new patients. I want to give you the best care possible. But in order to do so, because one size doesn't fit all, I need to know who you are as a person and in the context of your family. So that's what that's the place to start.
I had occasion just within the last 10 days, 2 weeks, to be taken to the hospital in one of those red boxes. It was completely unexpected, believe me. And I feel that I had the best care possible that was designed for me. And that short stay, that 5-day stay in the hospital. And my wife, my other half, Deborah, was the one that made sure that I received the best care possible. Mm. And this is another point that we've had a person on our show before discussing this. But at some point, the best care possible might be something that you yourself, as the patient, can't enunciate. You can't give that information because of your condition. So you need to have that advocate, don't you?
We certainly do. I mean, you know, let's face it. We have challenges in the healthcare system in the United States. Things are somewhat broken, and although we have the best treatments for many of the diseases that face us all as human beings and an aging population, our healthcare system is really more of a disease treatment system. And as people become seriously ill, or their family member becomes seriously ill, often advocacy is important, trying to navigate through a complex healthcare system and trying to coordinate care and get sound communication between multiple physicians who may be seeing a patient who has, you know, three or four serious diagnoses, all becomes very complicated. And when somebody is seriously ill and they may be, frankly, too sick to advocate well for themselves, it really does fall to friends and family to advocate for them. It makes it very important to have the conversation. There's going to be, later this summer, there's going to be actually a national project called the Conversation Project that's going to be launching to really engage the American public in sitting down, you know, metaphorically around the kitchen table and talking about those things we spend our lives trying not to talk about, which is what happens and what do we want in terms of care when we're seriously ill and may not even be expected to survive. What does the best care look like at that time? So these are important topics that we all need to be mindful of for our own sake and, frankly, for the well-being of our families.
You've hit so many nails on the head in that very short statement that you made there as it pertained to me. I had a case. The reason I went into the hospital in the first place was as an outpatient to have a hernia taken care of. But there was an issue where all of a sudden I found myself a day and a half later at home and crashing. But prior to going in, I got in there and everything. Although I didn't know what was going on, Deborah did a great job and directed everything and told people what I needed, what I wanted. But there was a case where there were no less than I think four or five physicians. I have a cardiologist, and he treats me for my AFib.
Right.
I have a kidney specialist because I have some kidney issues, and that was part of my reason for going in is to have a catheter put in. Then also there was the surgeon, the orthoscopic surgeon, and the general surgeon that were both in the operating room, as well as a general practice physician. There's five right there, not to mention the emergency room doc. the nurses and day-to-day care people. I mean, it's a real communication thing, and you got all these people, and you've got to make sure that they're all talking to one another.
Well, you know, this is a challenge that faces us all. I'm so delighted to be on Boomer and the Babe because we baby boomers, we 78 million of us, are stressing and challenging the system in ways that are utterly unprecedented, and we live in unprecedented times. You know, people in years past used to die of many of the things that now we live with for sometimes many years, at least for months, and often quite well. I, for one, celebrate the prowess of medicine to keep us alive, to fight disease, to help us live longer and live better. The problem is, Pete, that we've yet to make even one person immortal.
That's right.
And since, as they say in the movies, no one gets out of this one alive,
mm-hmm.
At some point in time, more disease treatment must not be better care for a human being, for a person. You know, we spend our lives in American culture really trying to avoid any notion, any discussion of illness and dying and caregiving, including for our parents or our spouses, and grief. In fact, that phrase, "I don't want to think about it," really captures the American mindset when it comes to these serious but inevitable parts of human life. So we live in unprecedented times. Not only are we an aging, you know, population, and all of us baby boomers, you know, we're already paying senior discounts at the movies and on buses and Medicare, you know, many of us have already started to receive our Medicare cards and the like. But it's important also to recognize that in the latter part of the 20th century, we invented chronic illness. You know, people used to die of many of the things that now we live with.
Right.
So as we go forward, I think we've mislearned that more treatment is better care because so often, you know, people don't die of heart attacks like they used to in the 1950s and 60s when I was growing up. We have good treatments now. We have medicines to dissolve clots, and we have stents, and we have statins, and all of those things. Great. People don't die in the first few weeks, at least, of having a cancer diagnosis. We're now curing over 50% of solid tumors, and even those we can't cure often become chronic illnesses that people live with for many, many months. And I could go on and on. Kidney failure, liver failure, congestive heart failure, all of these things now are, for so many of us, chronic illnesses. And again, that's a good thing. But we have to bring the same attention to detail and commitment to the best care to these latter phases of human life as well. To this point in time, we haven't done that. We haven't done it as a health system. We haven't done it as a society. And frankly, as boomers, as you know, we are the pinnacle of consumer advocates, citizen consumer advocates.
Right, right.
But we haven't talked about this as a generation, at least not collectively as a generation. You know, when I'm sitting on a plane reading a professional journal, and the person next to me looks over and says, "Doctor, what do you do?" And I say, "Well, I'm in palliative care," and then I have to explain what that is. But when I do, they say, "You know, funny thing, my mom's seriously ill now. We're caring for her. We're worrying about, you know, a nursing home for her and what a good nursing home would look like. Or funny thing, I just had my father-in-law just died last year, and boy, he went through hell with his prostate cancer and Parkinson's disease." And it's as if, gee, it's just a coincidence. I can tell you, it's not just a coincidence. It's happening to all of us. I don't know anybody my age who isn't in the midst of or has just gone through a difficult period of parent care for their own parents or their in-laws. And I got to tell you, those of us who've been through it, even those of us who are doctors and nurses, have found it's not been easy. It's been hard. Even those of us who understand and work in this complex healthcare system in America have found it hard to often get the best care for those that we love. Nowadays, we're starting to worry about not only ourselves in the future, but, Pete, to tell you the truth, I worry also about my daughters and my wife caring for me in the future. So that's why, frankly, I have things like advanced directives and have started having these conversations.
Define what it is that you do and what you are as expert and adept at, which is, of course, palliative care.
Sure.
Define palliative care for our listeners so they know exactly what we're talking about.
Sure. It's not that odd a thing. And, you know, people often think about hospice care, which is really the gold standard of care for someone we love when they're dying, right? And palliative care has grown out of the hospice discipline base. Palliative care is, much like hospice is, a interdisciplinary, team-based approach to care for people's comfort and quality of life when they have a life-threatening illness and support for their families. So we're a whole team, doctors, nurse practitioners, nurses, social workers, chaplains. We have our own volunteers. We have healing arts or massage and therapists and art therapists to work with people. We're a team that helps support people who are living with serious illness and their families. We help in many ways. We help with symptom management. We're experts in pain management and the management of other symptoms that come along with advanced illness. But we also help people to sort of walk through this journey that they would never have chosen, helping them in making good decisions about their treatment or their loved one's treatment through the course of an illness in a serial fashion, in an iterative way. And that brings me back to helping people decide for themselves or their parents or spouses who are ill what the best care possible is now, given your values and your own personal preferences, and then going forward, revisiting that. As a disease either responds to treatment and a person's condition gets better, or the disease progresses and people gradually become more ill, revisiting. So what's the best care now for you and your loved one? And frankly, that's what we do, focusing on helping, accompanying people through this difficult time, helping them decide really for themselves what the best care is, and then applying that to a care plan that's highly individualized, that helps to to implement and actualize the best care for them and support for their families.
It's interesting to me because it's not been that way with my parents. As I had mentioned, my father's passed away now for about 7 years. My mother is elderly, and the care process and the request for what happens if are already on paper. They're legally signed, sealed, and delivered. The DNR is in place should it ever be needed. But there are so many families or so many couples that don't want to talk about this. It's like
right.
it's this big taboo.
Right.
And then
you just named it. You said it's a taboo. I think there's superstition is alive and well in our supposedly sophisticated postmodern, you know, third millennium society. We're so sophisticated scientifically and in many ways culturally, and yet taboos or superstition is alive and well in America. We think that if we don't think about it, somehow it's not going to happen. That just is wrong. It still happens. Illness and even dying still happens. If we haven't thought about it and we haven't talked about it, it just happens. When it happens, we're just less prepared for it, and we're more at risk for it all to happen to us in a way that we would not have wanted.
Well, what really, I don't know if you've ever seen that old commercial, but that really chaps my hide. Well, one of the things that chaps my hide is now, especially in this electoral season, and having the discussions with regard to the Affordable Health Care Act and everything else that's going on, and who's going to cut it off and who's going to eliminate it and this, that, and the other thing, it just occurs to me that there are so many fear tactics that
yep.
are being instilled, death panels, you know,
yep.
they're going to throw grandma off the cliff. You know, that commercial when they wheeled it up with a wheelchair and threw grandmother off the cliff into the ocean. There's so much of that going on. What is your view of the way things are now? What do you think of what might come of it if it remains, and what is the option if it doesn't?
So it's unsustainable as it is. I mean, we're now spending almost 17% of our nation's gross domestic product on health care. That's almost twice what any other developed country is spending. It's unsustainable, and it's already ravaging our capacity to provide fire protection and police protection and good schooling for our children. And it's also eroding our manufacturing section. As you know, it costs more to take care of the health care bills for employees than steel for the people who make our cars. I mean, it's an unsustainable situation. But I don't think we need to ration. And in fact, we don't need more money to take much better care of people through the end of life. If this was a TV interview, Pete, I'd want that to be the crawl that below our interview. We don't need more money. We really have plenty of money that we are investing in the last 2 years or so of people's lives. What we need is better return on our investment. But the scare tactics have really poisoned the civil discourse about this, really what is a health crisis in America today, and it's really made it difficult to talk about. Politicians, you know, treat these topics as if they're radioactive. Because on the one hand, you have people who are loudly promoting physician-assisted suicide, as if people, you know, need to die by their own hand or with the help of a physician in order to retain their dignity. And on the other hand, you have people waving this banner of death panels, for heaven's sakes, and talking about, you know, even those of us in hospice and palliative care are somehow killing granny. Well, you know, this is totally offensive, and it's completely and utterly inaccurate. There's never been any kernel of truth in any of this. I think we've been pinned down by the crossfire of the culture war for too long. And it's time to take back this discussion. In the book, In the Best Care Possible, which is a book of stories that I try to tell, that I tell of real patients and often friends of mine and family members who I know as a physician, I've cared for patients or people who in my life, and I try to use those stories to explain and unpack some of the both advice that I give to people and some of the really falsehoods that are out there that are really poisoning the public discourse. One of the things we have to do, frankly, is we have to declare the branding of the terms dignity on the one hand and pro-life on the other to be null and void. The political combatants can't have those two words because it makes it really difficult to talk about what really enlightened care looks like without being able to use the terms dignity and pro-life. Let me explain. I am a lifelong, proud political progressive. I hope people don't turn off their radios when I say that. But I am, and anybody who reads the book will find that. But I am also proudly, ardently pro-life. In fact, a reverence for life permeates the field of hospice and palliative care. In fact, to be perfectly honest, it permeates health care. We're all pro-life. Don't you want your doctors and nurses to be pro-life? It's not about capital P pro-life politics. It has nothing to do with abortion. But doctors and nurses reflexively promote and protect life. In hospice and palliative care, we're the ones who show up when people are seriously ill, when they may be wrestling with serious decisions, when they may be suffering from pain and other difficult to tolerate symptoms. We show up and are there day by day helping them work through this. On the other hand, although I happen to be strongly opposed to the legalization of physician-assisted suicide, I am proudly, ardently pro-dignity. You know, the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN starts with a preamble that says all members of the human family are inherently dignified. This is a settled matter of human ethics. My job, our team's job, all of healthcare's job, really, and frankly our society's job, is to help care for people in ways that allow them to feel their inherent dignity through the end of life, despite their frailty, their physical dependence. Having to be cared for in the most basic of ways doesn't make our grandparents or our parents undignified. It simply makes us all human. Caring for one another in this way is a species-specific characterization. Character. It's part of our traits. It's part of what humanity does. So I frankly, as I've done interviews around The Best Care Possible, this book, as I've taken calls from listeners and viewers, as I've done public lectures and done Q&A, I can tell you that the culture war is a mirage in this as it relates to the end of life. The large, vast majority of Americans stand together on high common ground. You know, we want the best care for our loved ones. We want the best medical treatments as long as it has any value in helping us live longer and live well. But when the time comes when we have to leave this life, we want care that is competent and comprehensive from a medical and nursing perspective, but also we want care that is tender and loving for the people that we love. We want not only them to be comfortable and clean, we want them to be honored and celebrated in their last days. I got to tell you, that all of that we can deliver on with less money now than we're spending now, less money than we're spending now. But if we can have the conversation, if we can simply set aside our ongoing disagreements about, for instance, physician-assisted suicide, and say, okay, we're going to agree to disagree about that, let the debates continue. But meanwhile, can the adults in the room come together and talk about what the best care looks like? And work together, even those of us who disagree on so many other matters, can we work together to provide comprehensive, competent care in a manner that's highly individualized, tender, and loving? My answer to that is, of course we can.
Well, you certainly hope that we could. But then when you look at the political landscape, because it all seems nowadays to be coming down to the political landscape, men versus women, death panels versus not death panels, caring for grandma versus putting her on an ice floe and letting her go out to sea.
Yeah, these are false dichotomies, though. This is stuff, if we continue to be victim of the polarized political landscape, I got to tell you, all of us as baby boomers should worry about the future. As bad as health care for people at the end of life is today, these may be the good old days. You know, people tell me
right.
They don't want to go to nursing homes. Trust me, the nursing homes of tomorrow may make the nursing homes we deal with today look like luxury hotels.
Right.
The demographics aren't lining up in the right directions. All of this is unnecessary. This is one social crisis we can fix. Remember the crawl at the bottom of the screen. We don't need more money. We have to have the conversation both in our own families as well as collectively as a society.
I definitely agree with what you're saying. There's just absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, I'm 100% in your corner. I get so frustrated, however, to think that these people that want to be or are our leaders, supposedly, can't come to grips with this situation without using, as I said earlier, the fear tactics.
I think that's just part of American politics that's poisoning civil discourse.
It is. It's so counterproductive.
And, my answer to it has been to write a book, to get on the talk shows, to begin to call attention to the truth so that we can debunk some of this unnecessary conflict. I mean, I just said it. I'm taking back the term pro-life. I refuse to have those charges have any sting anymore. I totally believe that the controversy around death panels is completely without substance. It really was never a real issue. I mean, if you go back, and I did go back and do the research. Sarah Palin, you know, created that term in a blog that she or in a Facebook post in spring of 2009. It was targeted against the health care reform bill, but less than a year earlier, she had signed a proclamation as governor of Alaska, calling for everyone in Alaska, all adults, to complete advance directives. Exactly what she demonized before. Now, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, that's just not right. I mean, that was disingenuous. Chuck Grassley did the same thing. This is not an issue. And then the religious leaders who kind of piled on and said, well, you know, this health care reform bill is somehow against Christian ethics. I'm sorry, but that's just poppycock. I've been studying ethics, both Christian ethics and Judeo-Christian ethics and others for many, many years. I can tell you that there is nothing in Judeo-Christian principles that requires people to have CPR or medically administered nutrition and hydration to prolong life. It's simply not true. And, you know, I'm very proud that even, you know, as a progressive, a liberal and progressive politically, that several evangelical leaders have endorsed my book, The Best Care Possible. They've read the whole thing, and although they don't, we don't agree on many aspects of politics outside of this realm, they fully agree with me, make a clear distinction between killing people, which I'm not for and I don't believe in doing, I don't think it's a doctor's role, between killing people and allowing people to die gently.
The allowing people to die gently is, I think that might well be the key phrase.
Yeah.
At some point, you can let nature take its course.
It's so true. You know,
yeah,
nature in her wisdom, or if you prefer, God in his wisdom, have given we human beings gentle ways of leaving this life. And that's a discussion, again, we have to talk about, because doctors tend, every time somebody gets a diagnosis or the a new complication, you know, you already have cancer that's spread, but now you have a blood clot or now you have an infection. Every time you get a new diagnosis, it comes with potential treatments. But, and that's not wrong, but we've lost the big picture that nature gives us gentle ways to leave this life. And out of love of life and love of our loved ones, we close the doors to the easy ways to leave this life, you know, treating infections, a new surgery for a complication or blood thinners or whatever. All of that's not wrong, but at some point it has diminishing returns. And every right. time we close a door to a gentle way to leave this life, we pretty much force somebody's body to find another way to leave this life.
Exactly.
And we've actually inadvertently made dying a lot harder than it used to be.
Well, I don't mean to be hung up on the political aspect of things.
That's okay. It's important to talk about.
But I think where this first came to light with me, then it really hit home. I mean, I've always been, you know, kind of around the edges on it. I knew that my parents had their directives and all that good stuff, and they were in order, and I have a copy. My sister has a copy. Everybody that's involved, would be involved in the decisions, has a copy. Everything's wonderful. We accept that. We're thankful for it. It's because it's a gift. But what it really hit home to me is years ago, with the Terry Schiavo case.
Sure.
And all of a sudden I see these muckety-mucks in Washington on different sides of this issue when it's none of their, pardon my Spanish, damned business.
Sure.
And that really, that's where when I see that kind of stuff happening in the political arena, and for them to, they say they don't want big government, but then who's going to make sure that their new rules and regulations are being followed? It's got to be the government. And it goes on and on and on. You can cite case after case after case, and it doesn't do anybody any good except it raises money for them from the special interest so they can continue to be in office.
That's well, frankly, you just put your finger on it. The culture war raises money for political candidates, but it also raises money for political movements. And the capital P pro-life movement and the assisted suicide movement thrive on controversy, which is pinning us all down as a caring, loving society and keeping us from giving people the best care possible. This is really unnecessary. It's really destructive, socially destructive, and it's certainly not life-affirming by any stretch of the imagination. We just have to say, enough is enough. Have your fights, but the rest of us, what I equipped as the adults in the room, need to get busy taking back the end of life and making it as good as we can possibly make it.
Well, I think the adults in the room need to take back a whole bunch of stuff in this country. And,
you bet.
And tell these people to go whatever we tell them to go do.
Right. I mean, there's a precedent for this. If you don't mind me going forward, you know,
sure.
We boomers, we've always been the me generation. We only accept the very best. And, you know, we question authority.
Right.
And we want to get the very best for ourselves and our loved ones, and we want to pay the right price for it, right? I think, frankly, we have precedent within our own history that gives us a sense of what's needed in the future. Bear with me here for a moment. You know, in the 1960s and 70s, when I was growing up and becoming a young adult, we boomers took back the beginning of life. You know, the birthing movement provides an excellent example of what's needed going forward. When I was growing up, they didn't allow fathers into delivery rooms.
Right.
It was unheard of.
Right.
You know, many women were given general anesthesia during labors. I was born under general anesthesia.
Yes.
And mothers and babies were kept in hospitals for 5 to 10 days. When I was, you know, in college, the birthing movement was in full bloom, and they were just testing whether it was okay, safe to have fathers in delivery rooms. The doctors were worrying that if you let fathers in delivery rooms, they'd fall over, they'd faint, they'd hurt themselves. But, of course, they didn't. It was a citizen consumer movement that drove the change toward natural birthing. Medicine and science ultimately supported that change, and we found out that it was safe and that birthing coaches were really good for women, and attending birthing classes was important. And by golly, look what's happened. Nowadays, we worry if fathers aren't in the delivery rooms. And we worry if women don't have birthing coaches and they haven't been through prepared childbirth classes. Hospitals now compete for baby business by maintaining homey birthing suites that can accommodate a couple and a family. So a very similar thing needs to happen. If you think about it, in the birthing movement, we as a generation said that the fact that pregnant women and women delivering children need expert medical attention is a given, and we're going to demand that they get the best medical treatment possible. But the need for health care does not define pregnancy or childbirth as being primarily a medical experience. It is fundamentally a personal experience for the woman, for the infant, and for their family. And we took it back. Now, we boomers are facing the other side, the other end of the life cycle, and it demands our same attention. We need to take this back. The fact is that illness and dying are only partly medical. They're first and foremost profoundly personal for the individual and their family. And in very similar ways, we need to demand expert medical care, including symptom management and good communication, good continuity of care and coordination and planning for our seriously ill loved ones and for all of us as families. But the need for medical care does not define these times as being primarily medical. They are first and foremost personal for the person who is ill and will be dying, but also for our families. We need to take it back. There's a lot of work, and we can talk about some of the specific things that would dramatically improve care, medical care, for people who are seriously ill. But beyond that, we need to redefine these times as being personal. And if we did that, then some of the advocacy work that needs to be done, having the conversation, completing our advance directives, making sure that our loved ones have clear authority to speak for us so that, you know, we don't need ethics committees or, heaven forbid, like in the Schiavo case, a state legislature or governor or, my goodness, the National Congress to get involved. A simple advance directive form would have stopped all of that in the Terry Schiavo case, and it can prevent it. And prevent conflict within our own families. But we need to go further and really raise our expectations dramatically and then work together to get those expectations met.
I just wrote a blog, a very short blog recently. I've yet to publish it, but it has to do with a lot of what you're talking about, not with regard to healthcare, but with regard to the boomer cohort. And I was questioning in my blog as to whether or not the boomer cohort still has the heart, still has the courage of their convictions that they had in the 60s and the 70s, or have they gotten so passive about everything that they just let it go on around them and have it done to them rather than stand up and say, hell no, we won't go, like they did during the Vietnam War. And say the same thing about health care and say the same thing about all kinds of other issues that are going on with the government nowadays. And I don't know whether or not they have, we as a cohort have the heart to do that as we did when we were younger. I'm a little concerned.
Well, I'm concerned too, and I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I think we could do it. You know, this is one national crisis we really could fix, but whether we will fix it, not sure. I got to tell you, what motivates me, Pete, is not that I worry about myself and the care that I will get as I'm facing the end of life or my wife will get, although I worry plenty about that. I worry at least as much about the experience of my daughters. Mm-hmm. Because as I've promised, you know, our parents that they'd get the best care, that we wouldn't let them suffer, that they wouldn't let them feel abandoned, that we wouldn't warehouse them in some nursing home that's woefully understaffed. I know my daughters feel the same way about us, but it's going to get harder, not easier, to keep those promises. And having just been through, and we're still caring for my mother-in-law, knowing how much of a struggle it is for us, even though my wife and I are savvy about these things, I'm motivated for the sake of my daughters to fix these issues now while we can. You know, we boomers have the generational traits that make us savvy citizen consumer advocates. I hope we get motivated to invest that energy to fix these issues. But as you say, the politics are poison, and they may derail us. I hope that's not the case. All I can do is to raise expectations and let people know through the stories in The Best Care Possible, the book, that it is possible, even today, to cut through these complexities and to get much better care for you and those you love.
It's when my father was in need of continued medical care, he was in a nursing home. He was in a skilled nursing facility, it was amazing the vigilance and the diligence and the out-and-out almost nastiness that I had to practice to make sure that he got everything that he needed to have on a day-to-day basis. This was considered to be one of the finest facilities in our area here in the Sun City, Arizona area. And when there's certain things, and maybe you can address this, it's a little off the subject, but it's somewhat related. My dad has had Alzheimer's, as I mentioned. He was hard of hearing. He wouldn't put his hearing aids in. He had trouble getting down towards the end. He had trouble speaking and being coherent and things like that. And he startled very easily, and he didn't want anybody to touch him to cleanse him or whatever, because he was a very personal man, very private man. And when they came in to change him, to bathe him, whatever, I mean, he would scream out of anger and disgust. He would thrash about from time to time. He had Coumadin. His skin would split open, and he would have open sores. It really did get nasty. Now, but the point being, and I think that I'm getting to here, is that I put a sign over his bed, and the sign said, "Dementia patient, does not hear, do not startle, speak into his left ear, ask him for assistance, and he will be more liable to cooperate." They had to take that sign down because it was a HIPAA violation. What the hell were they going to do? I don't care who knew that my dad had dementia. He was hard of hearing. He was a bit of a pain in the ass.
So they didn't have to take it down. They were wrong.
Exactly.
With your permission, you know, that's just silly. And having a sign in somebody's own room doesn't violate HIPAA. If that violated HIPAA, you'd have to put a mask on the patient because somebody might recognize him.
Right.
You know, that's just absurd. But it points your story, which is painful even to hear, Pete, is not unusual. I applaud people who work in nursing homes. Some of the most dedicated colleagues that I know work in nursing homes, and I applaud the nurses and the aides. But let's face it, the nursing homes in general in our country, despite a few excellent examples, are in total crisis. They are staffed at about half of the level that they're supposed to be. We're not paying nurses' aides and even the nurses who work in nursing homes a fair wage. Many of the aides who work in nursing homes aren't getting a living wage. The turnover rate among aides in nursing homes approaches 70 to 80 to 90% each year. Think about that. So, right. I know nursing homes where it's over 100% a year, meaning that many of the positions turn over more than once in a year. And if you interview, and I have, aides in nursing homes and say, you know, we know you don't get paid very much. We know that your own health benefits are poor. You know, why do you do this work? They will uniformly say, because we love these people. I love to take care of elderly or frail people. These are our employees that we're abusing in many ways in America. We don't pay them what we pay elementary school teachers, who are also underpaid, by the way. But these are the people who care for our parents and our grandparents, and it's a national disgrace that we're not paying them well. Now, people, remember the crawl at the bottom of the screen. We don't need more money. We could dramatically improve the staffing in nursing homes, diminish the turnover rate in nursing homes, and all of a sudden, all of the training that we want to do, all of the higher levels of skill sets education and knowledge that we want the nurses aides to have would become achievable. In Canada, just a little north of us, their per capita spending for elderly and frail people, including in nursing homes, is roughly half of what we spend. The difference is that they, because their staffing is better, they don't have to send people to hospitals when they get infection or when they have new pains. They tend to have much less time in the hospital during the last 6 months of life than in America. And you can pay for a lot of aid-level care. You can pay for a lot of hand feeding rather than using, you know, feeding tubes when somebody has a problem swallowing. You can do a lot of care planning if you're saving people from spending time that they don't want to spend either, by the way, in hospitals during the last days of life. So we've got this basically upside down. And, you know, I'm sorry to when I criticize nursing homes, sometimes I get emails and hurt letters from people who work there saying, well, you know, we can't do anything to please you folks. That's not the case. It really isn't. I'm not criticizing them. But as an industry, you know, the nursing home industry, which is still being traded well on Wall Street and extracting profits from Medicare and from our private dollars for the care of our grandparents and parents, needs to better serve not only the people who are residents there, but the people who work there. We could save large amounts of money and take not just a little bit better care, much better care of our loved ones if the places were better staffed. And I just have one more point about this. Those who disagree with me about assisted suicide, who are claiming that we need to pass these Death with Dignity Acts, you know, if you really want to preserve people's dignity, then we need to make sure that there's somebody to answer the bell in a nursing home when our parents need to get to the bathroom and need help in doing so, or our parents are wet and need to be changed. You know, we can help people, even in their disabilities, feel entirely dignified, as I believe they are, if we can help them in a way that shows their dignity reflected in our eyes. But if there's nobody to answer the bell, then our loved ones are going to feel undignified simply because they're frail and need help. And that's patently wrong. We have enough money to do it well today. We simply need to do it.
Well, it's I'm listening intently to what you're saying with regard to staffing, and I distinctly remember that when I said to the people at this skilled nursing facility that my father was housed in and supposedly getting great care in, when I said, "Where is the nurse?" they said, "Well, the nurse has 12 different patients that she's responsible for." And I said, "What about the aide?" She says, "Well, each aide has 6 different patients that they're responsible for." And I'm going on and maybe those weren't exactly the numbers, but it was along the lines of, how thin are you spreading these people? No wonder my dad can't get care.
Exactly. This is totally unnecessary, you know? And then, so what happens in the middle of the night if there's one nurse on for 40 people or 2 aides on for, you know, 30 people? There are nursing homes today that don't have nurses, don't have RNs on at night.
Yeah.
If one patient has a fever or starts, you know, complaining of pain or starts to vomit, perhaps, What do? Well, they ship them to the hospital because they don't have the staffing to care for them there. And so that's how elderly people end up in hospitals. They end up in ambulances and emergency departments and in hospitals. 20% of Americans now have an ICU stay in the days before their death. 20% of Americans end up in ICUs just before they die. So, you know, this is enormously expensive and isn't associated with anything that you or I would recognize as good quality.
Well, it's interesting the way you said that, because it's bringing back these visions. I mean, I got a call, and the last time my father was in this care facility, I got a call, and the call said, "Mr. Peters, you probably should come here. Your father had a tough night, and he was very combative, and his skin in various locations had broken open, and he had lost what they thought was a significant amount of blood." And he says, "But he won't let anybody come near him. But you need to come over and see if you can help us." So of course I went, and there he was, laying in a fair amount of blood, and I also realized that he had very thin skin. You know how that is when you're taking the
we call it parchment skin.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. And they put tape on him. And despite the fact that in his chart and also on his bed, this was in the facility, not the hospital, it said no tape. In other words, use the Coban or whatever it is, the elastic. And I went through the roof. So anyhow, we got him cleaned up. He did eat. I'll never forget it. He ate a little bit of Cheerios and a couple bites of banana, and the nurse said, "We need to take him to the hospital because I think he lost a significant amount of blood." So we took him, and he gave got 2 pints of whole blood, another unit of plasma or whatever it was, and he settled out, and he was in the hospital. That's from there he went to hospice. But the point in all of this is they didn't, possibly know how, didn't have the facility, didn't have the personnel. They were totally understaffed and unmanned, basically. And now my father was going to die. We know he was going to die, but he didn't have to go that way. And he didn't have to have that indignity, that pain, that fear before he finally went to hospice and had a peaceful end.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's hard to even listen to, and I'm so sorry it happened to you, but it didn't just happen to you. It's happening in your dad. It's happened to so many families. We can fix this. We can get this happening much, much better. I applaud what you're doing on the show. We boomers have to get engaged, if not for ourselves, for our children. We have to begin to take this back. I hope that the stories in the book and some of the suggestions and advice that I give, practical ways for you to get the best care for people you love, will be helpful to listeners. By the way, I'd also say, this conversation project is going to launch later this summer. I know that there's a major broadcast outlet who are right now looking for families who would be interested in having the conversation around their kitchen table or in their living room while respectful cameras are there and a film crew is there to record and broadcast these conversations so that their family's experience could contribute to stimulating the conversations and making it acceptable to have them for families all across the country. This fire has to be lit. And it's going to start with a spark. The spark is what's happened to you and your family, Pete, to me and my family, to the people I write about in The Best Care Possible. But here's a way for our listeners today to contribute to having that spark catch fire and become a movement across the country. I don't think we boomers are done. It's I say when I'm talking to boomers in an audience, I often say it's time for us to grow the rest of the way up. We have to get past our resistance to talking about these issues. We have to finally acknowledge that we're mortal. We're gonna die. My best advice is let's get over it and then get on with living as fully and as well as possible. We ought to be getting much better care. And as savvy consumers and advocates, as we've always been, it's time to take back the end of life. So, you know, that's the work ahead. I think that's the generational work that's yet to be done.
There's a more colorful way of saying it that I would. It's grow a pair.
Yeah. Well, it's time. It's really time.
It really is. It really is. Well, I applaud you for your book. I applaud you for the work that you do, and I think it's absolutely phenomenal work that you do. And just by the basis of this conversation alone, I hope we can start to make a little bit of a difference. That conversation project that you mentioned, I spoke with one of the representatives of the agency that's involved with that. They impressed me tremendously with what they're going to do. I hope that maybe the Boomer and the Babe can be involved in that in some small way.
Would be great. I have a website called thebestcarepossible.org.
Okay.
If anybody's interested who's listening, send me an email and I'll get it to the people at the Conversation Project and put the listeners in touch with the people who are directing the Conversation Project. I'd love to hear from listeners and hear their stories as well and begin to fan the flames of this movement that really does have to happen.
Why don't you give us that website one more time, Doctor?
It's thebestcarepossible.org. The Best Care Possible is the name of the book, and I'd love to hear from you.
Well, very good. I certainly do appreciate your taking the time to be on the show today. And as I said, I think before we started the program or in the beginning of the program, we're going to have to do this again because there are so many things yet to be said and yet to be touched on that we could sit here for another 2 hours and have a conversation.
Well, I'd welcome continuing the conversation. This is all about the conversation, and this is one conversation we all need to have. So thanks for having me on, and thanks for the work you and Deb are doing. It's great stuff.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being a guest. Have a great
Real
day.
Real pleasure.
And this has been the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, and thanks for everybody joining us today for the conversation that we think is always going to be good conversation. At least we hope it's good conversation that comes out of our show. Today we had a conversation with Dr. Ira Byock, MD, author of the book, The Best Care Possible. Go to his website, or you could Google him probably and find them there as well if that's the easiest way to do it. And be sure to come back again next week. We have some more great guests, and I think we're going to have to contact Dr. Byock and have him back again. As I said, there's pages and pages of things that we haven't even had a chance to talk about yet. We try to bring you good conversation, and we certainly did it today with a great guest. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe Show every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show. Take a look at our website, boomerandthebabe.com, and also watch for some new and exciting things that we're going to be doing, some new exciting adventures that we'll be involved in. Please be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. Have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy Father's Day.
To the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversations to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.